Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone. It's another one of those days that could be sunshine, but right now it's not.
And when I say with me, I mean virtually, not actually, or digitally. She's with
right.
me. Because I am holed up here in my condo in Austin, Texas, and Mom is back at her home in Mount Pleasant, Iowa. And I was down here when kind of the, you know what, hit the fan. I'm not allowed to say words like that on the air, but
right.
and decided it was just safer to stay put here rather than come back to Iowa for the duration. And my kids are here, and my grandkids are here, although I can't see the grandkids, but anyway, it's...
Well, I know, but I understand.
Yes,
I understand.
Yeah. When I was thinking about whether I should try and come back or not, and I thought, well, if this really is the apocalypse, where do I want to ride it out? And I always figured if there were a real end of the world sort of situation, that I would try and get down here rather than staying in Iowa, because they don't have winter down here. But of course, we're a long ways from that, and we're a long ways from this being that drastic too.
Right, we hope.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that, by the way.
So, Mom, why don't you introduce our guest today?
Okay, it'd be my privilege to do that. Our guest today is Pat McKee, and he was born in Miami, Florida. After the early deaths of his parents, he grew up at Thornwall, an orphanage in Clinton, South Carolina. Following high school, he worked his way through Georgia State University and Emory Law School. Pat and his wife, Donna, live in Newman, Georgia, where he practices law, and they have two children. He's always been a writer, and Ariel's Island, which is the book we're talking about today, is his first book of fiction, and believe me, it is a page-turner.
Yeah, Mom, we talked a few days ago, and she was pretty caught up in this, and I was,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's
wonderful to hear.
And I was, too. So Ariel's Island is kind of the underlying theme is, can artificial intelligence learn morality? But it's more than that. It's really a legal thriller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 And it was interesting to me, of course, because my dad was an attorney, and I came from that background, and I have a daughter who's an attorney. So anyway. But it is an interesting book. It really is. But give yourself time to read it. I mean, you know, because you're gonna want to read it and read it and read it.
You're gonna want to know what happens. So Pat McKee is the author. Paul McDaniel is your hero in the book, and he. So there's PM, same initials, the McKee McDaniel, and he also grew up in an orphanage. And pretty sure you're a Southerner, and he's a Southerner. So how autobiographical is this book?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. And it is, in a sense, autobiographical. But here's how it arose. Many years ago, and I've been writing on this book for about 10 years, many years ago, some of my friends and family came to me and said, look, you've got an interesting story. You're a successful lawyer. You grew up in an orphanage. Why don't you write your story to try to inspire, others who might have had a difficult time in their childhood? And so I started out writing a memoir. And I finished the memoir, and I took it to an agent. And the agent, I'll summarize, basically, the agent said, this is way too bleak. Nobody wants to read this. Why don't you try writing something like a legal thriller and that you know, and put your protagonist in the same position that you were in? And I took on that challenge, and I did. So the protagonist is somewhat autobiographical. The there are many significant differences, but I did use my background as a source of information about the protagonist. So there's mm-hmm. a lot there, as you point out. Superficially, you know, I'm a Southerner, he's a Southerner, the initials are the same, he's a lawyer, I'm a lawyer, we both grew up in an orphanage, but the experiences are rather different. I wasn't quite as successful in my initial career as I allow my protagonist to be.
I'm assuming some of the kind of violent things that happened in the book did not happen to you.
Yeah, I think you can assume that I have not been attacked by a psychopath with an RPG or never been shot at like that. So no. I've lived a relatively tranquil life.
That's just what I was going to ask. So that's good. Yeah.
Most of that stuff is all from is from my imagination. Though I do have some, you know, as most Southerners, I have some familiarity with firearms. I can say that, but not RPGs. So we'll set the record straight there.
Well, what about boats and planes? Which also
boats
feature
and
in here.
Planes. Yeah, boats and planes. You know, fishing boats, fast boats. I did grow up in Miami, as you pointed out in the initial bio, and I certainly had plenty of experience when I was a younger person in Miami with people who had very fast boats and nice airplanes. So, yeah, I've had experience with that too.
It's interesting. I just read an article in Vanity Fair about personal jets and how they have become kind of the real status symbol in the Gulf Stream and kind of the guy who put Gulf Stream on the map and so forth. And so it was interesting. Then right after I finished this article, I'm reading Ariel's Island, and I believe there was a Gulf Stream, that somebody had a Gulf
Absolutely,
Stream.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, indeed. There's a very, very expensive Gulf Stream. And I don't, you know, travel in that circle. But I will say, from my understanding, if you really, really want to throw away a lot of money, buy a private jet.
Yeah, for sure. But then they also say once you travel that way, you never want to go any other way. But
well, nowadays with all of this social isolation, I think if we're going to travel at all, we're going to have to do privately.
I know. When I was thinking about whether to go back to Iowa, I had, you know, if I did go, or at some point if I do go, should I drive or should I fly? And at first I thought, well, I'll drive, it's safer. But then someone mentioned, well, public restrooms on rest stops on the way and hotels, it's more, you know, you can't make it in one day, are probably as risky as airports are now because nobody's flying.
So, Monica, you've just talked yourself into buying a private jet.
Well, somehow I did get on somebody's email list for one of these jet sharing companies.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, I could do that, I guess.
Yeah. That's the next best thing to owning your own, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So,
you
set out to write a legal thriller. And, of course, in any thriller, plot is key. Characters
Absolutely.
Are also important, but your main character, because he's based on you, in a sense, was perhaps not that challenging to come up with his characteristics. But what about the plot? How did you develop that?
Yes. So I have always been fascinated by Shakespeare. And, you know, just a slight digression, I was an English and philosophy major in college, loved Shakespeare and fascinated by his plays. And the last of Shakespeare's plays, at least one that scholars think is his last is The Tempest. And if you know anything about The Tempest, what happens at the very end of The Tempest is Prospero, who is the wizard in the play, he decides to free Ariel, who happens to be a spirit who has helped him throughout the play. He frees Ariel, and he surrenders all of his magic. And a lot of scholars believe that this Prospero really is a stand-in for Shakespeare himself, and this is his kind of retirement announcement, where he's giving up his magic and he's freeing his creativity in the form of Ariel the spirit. And I have always been fascinated by this idea that what happened to Ariel, this all-powerful spirit that has been released into the world. So that was the kernel of this book, and I took loosely the plot of The Tempest, two brothers who are fighting over their inheritance. In the play, it's the Dukedom of Milan. In my book, it's Milano Corporation, and I use that as the basis for the plot. So having explained that, I bet, and you're having read the book, now you can see a little bit of where that plot came from.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I had read that in the publicity materials about the book, but I didn't really think about it as I was reading it. And I have some familiarity with the play. I've seen it performed. It's been a while. And also, all of Shakespeare's plays tend to run together in my head because they always have a duke and or a prince and a storm. And,
right.
And mistaken identity, and right. And often male versus male, female, you know, men disguising as women or vice versa, and some kind of jester, joker character.
Right.
And yeah. So.
Well, and the other thing about Shakespeare, as you probably know, Shakespeare stole basically all of his plots himself from others, and so I felt no compunction in stealing the plot from Shakespeare.
Well, they also say there's how many, like 30-some plots, and all books are sort of one of those. But
yeah.
But there's a lot. Okay, you can have the bare bones of a plot that's just like the bare bones of another plot and another, but the details are what make it really interesting.
Absolutely, yes.
So your villains in this play were quite villainous.
Yes, they are very villainous. From the very start, the very first scene of the book is the result of the action of one of the more villainous people in the book. So yes, the villains are really bad.
And there's quite a few of them.
Yes, yeah. You know, it's going back to Shakespeare, if people, I don't know, kind of seem to almost sanitize Shakespeare a bit by thinking of, you know, him in the Elizabethan era being kind of, kind of prim and proper, but he wasn't. And there were all kinds of dastardly villains in Shakespeare's plays, and incest and murder and, you know, all kinds of bad things happening. So, it comes from Shakespeare and is inspired by Shakespeare.
How long did you spend writing Ariel's Island?
So, from the start, when I first was challenged to write a memoir, that started about 10 years ago. Once I got my first rejection, as all of us do, by an agent, the next thing I did was to enroll at Kennesaw State University, which is a regional university here in Georgia, and they had a professional writing program, and I took the creative writing portion of that as a certificate program, and studied creative writing, and so I was able to develop over a period of time the basic plot, narrative, and everything for Ariel's Island. And then over the next probably 5 or 6 years, I kept revising, and finally you have what is in front of you.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Pat McKee, author of Ariel's Island.
I just wonder how he came up with this intricate plot of what happens to Paul. I mean, gosh, it's just, that's why it's a page turner, because you just want to know what in the world is he's going to do next and how he's going to get out of that mess he got himself into.
So, well, we're talking the plot details now. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I will say this. That was probably the most fun, if you can tell by reading it, how much fun it is to read it. It was that much fun to write it. I purposely got Paul into a lot of trouble and tried to figure out how to get him out. And so many, I'll say this for other writers out there. I know that there are so many writers who will say, I outlined this thing, before I ever put pen to paper, and I knew every turn of the plot and every turn of the storyline before I ever started writing. Well, I didn't. I started writing, and then I'd come back and say, he needs to have another problem get in his way here. This isn't challenging enough. And I'd go back and throw another, log in the middle of the road for him. So I kind of enjoyed making it difficult.
And did you know how he was going to get out of it in the end or not? I mean,
yes, I did. But he didn't get out of it in the end in a certain way, as you know from the ending. And which were,
yeah.
I hope I'm not going to have to divulge the ending.
No, we're not. No.
but I will say this, the ending, the beginning and the ending, I rewrote dozens of times. The beginning and the end kept evolving. The internal part of this book, the middle part of the book, I always had in my mind how things would go. Now, I will say that the love interest, Melissa, she did change a bit over time, but she is is based upon the love interest in The Tempest. Though only the difference in my book, and well, there's many differences, obviously, but one of the big differences is that Monica, who is the love interest in the Tempest, is a rather uninteresting, unchallenging love interest. She falls immediately in love with the protagonist as soon as she sees him. And in this particular book, as you know, not only does she not fall immediately in love with him, but there's all sorts of other complications along the way.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I wanted to make the female character as challenging as the protagonist, and I don't know if you think I did, but I sure tried.
Yes, you did. To me, you did absolutely, because I was wondering what's going to happen here?
Yeah, right. And I wanted to make it with a lot, high stakes, and not. Neither one of them. Well, Paul was a little bit more over his head in love with Melissa, but Melissa kind of kept her distance for most of the time.
Mm-hmm. that was what was so interesting, because you just didn't know where she was coming from, you know, for sure.
Right, right. And, you know, it took a long time for me to understand that as much as it would be kind of satisfying in a, you know, Hollywood happy ending sort of way to bring Paul and Melissa together and, you know, and have them walk hand in hand in the sunset, it's a whole lot more interesting to explore different possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
So, Pat, why don't you read a little bit from Ariel's Island?
Oh, yes, I'd love to. I'm glad you asked me. I wanted, what I thought I would do, we talked about the beginning and the evil people in the book. I thought I would read just the very first scene from the book and kind of set the tone of how the book takes off. So here it is. This is chapter one from Ariel's Island. There was a body dressed in a suit and tie, impaled on the fountain in front of the law firm of Strange and Fowler. Pumps recycling water from the basin below were spraying geysers through the corpse 20 feet into the air, the water now red from the blood of the unfortunate and illuminated at the precise point of their apogee by perfectly timed spotlights. The sun was not yet high enough to glint off the upper stories of the building. I was an associate at the firm, just trying to get a jump on the 18-hour Friday that lay ahead of me when chaos intervened in my otherwise orderly life. A riot of blue light hit me in the face as I turned the corner from my condo onto Peachtree Street. Dozens of pinging strobes and a mob of cops, EMTs, TV cameras, press, and onlookers prevented me from seeing anything more until I got to the doors of the glass and steel tower that housed the firm. After a glance, I ducked inside, not succumbing to the curiosity of the crowd craning to see more. After all, dead bodies in Midtown Atlanta aren't that rare. It didn't strike me until I walked into the building that he might be one of our own, when I heard indistinct whispers of a familiar name. My eyes darted from one end of the slammed lobby to the other, trying to find someone who might know, and I saw one of the partners. The blood seemed drained from his face as severely as from the corpse in the fountain. "Who?" "I'm sorry, Paul. It's Billingsley." "Good God, what?" "Suicide." "No, I can't. He wasn't. Must have jumped from the observation deck." I turned to grab a passing security guard. I flashed my ID. "Yes, Mr. McDaniel?" "Can't you turn off?" "We're trying. Everything's run by computers. No one can figure out how to turn off the fountain in the corner. Can't get the body out until we do. Afraid he might get electrocuted if anything is shorted out. The body's been in there for over an hour." "You can't let his wife see." "Too late." "Cop saw his wallet in the water, fished it out, called her. Poor lady lost it. EMTs had to sedate her. They just took her away in an ambulance." "Can't we at least keep his kids from..." He shook his head. "Every TV camera in the city is out there. His kids are likely watching it broadcast live on the hall monitors at school." Damn. Billingsley. I'd worked with Frank Billingsley for the entire 6 years I had been at the firm. Most of the time on just one case, Socorix Limited versus Milano Corporation. Socorix came out of nowhere, claimed three key Milano patents, and hired Hector Cabrini, having recently won the largest judgment in state history against an airline manufacturer, to recover lost profits in the millions and secure intellectual property worth billions. Milano tapped Strange and Fowler, Atlanta's most prestigious law firm, for its defense. I had just started there as an associate, right out of Emory Law, just 2 weeks before the case was filed. So that's how it starts.
And that's Pat McKee reading from Ariel's Island. And you are listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. Now, Ariel becomes quite an important character, and she is, I don't think it's giving it away to tell that she's AI. She's artificial intelligence.
Right.
Paul does not know that at first.
Right.
But he does learn it fairly soon. What is your interest in AI?
Well, my interest in AI really comes from a kind of a philosophical standpoint. As the book explores, most artificial intelligence is not necessarily programmed with any idea of morality. The first instance in the book is just a simple one that Ariel, the artificial intelligence program, is noted as not being very modest. She's very sure of herself. And you can see this in any other kind of, you know, off-the-shelf artificial intelligence program like Alexa or Siri. The last thing you would want to have happen is you to say, well, Siri, who won the 1930 World Series? And Siri say, well, I know, but it's just showing off if I told you. You know, so modesty is certainly not something you want in an artificial intelligence program. But I explore the idea that how difficult it would be to program artificial intelligence with morality. And if I could, I'd like to just give you one quick instance of a problem that this presents for us. There was a few months ago an opinion piece in the New York Times. It was written by a very capable, knowledgeable person about who knows about computers. The person is the head of the computer science department at Cal Berkeley. And this particular article explored this similar question, and that is, so what would be the problem with an artificial intelligence program not having been programmed with morality? And he posited this particular problem. He said, what if we give to a powerful computer and artificial intelligence program the problem of solving one of the biggest challenges we face in humanity, and that is global warming? And we ask the computer, solve this problem for us. And we give the computer the ability not only to pose a solution, but to carry out the solution. And what if the computer thinks and whirs and whatever computers do and comes up with a solution? And that is, well, we just do away with human beings. They're the cause of global warming. And since supercomputers control most of the global power grid, it wouldn't take very long for computers simply to shut down all of our power and all of our ability to live as modern humans, and soon we'd be plunged into the Stone Age. So that really, I think, for me, kind of coalesced this particular problem of why should artificial intelligence have some kind of moral code, and if so, what?
Of course, writers have been exploring this issue for a long time. 2001, A Space Odyssey is one of the earlier ones that I can recall. But
right.
Back then, it was all really sci-fi because a computer like HAL didn't actually exist. But now, how close to reality is Ariel?
I think Ariel is, as far as I can tell, with just a couple of maybe leaps, if you will, Ariel is well within the power of current artificial intelligence programs. Now, the couple of things that I think might be stretching the ability of artificial intelligence currently is how she might project her appearance in certain other media. For example, in one instance, she projects herself into a room there and I let one of the characters say it looks a lot like when Princess Leia projected herself into in front of Obi-Wan Kenobi from R2-D2 and in the Star Wars movie. But I do believe that artificial intelligence is very close to being able to project holograms and other appearances very much like it happened in Star Wars.
What about like her ability to basically find out just about anything?
Yeah, isn't that scary? Well,
yeah.
I think that most very powerful computers have the ability now to read faces from cameras. We're seeing this in airports. We're seeing this in other security situations. The ability of a supercomputer to process visual images and also process multiple conversations. We happen to know of organizations, and maybe I should not name it, but an organization that is in McLean, Virginia, that has supercomputers that's doing this right now.
That's a little scary.
They're probably listening to us.
It is, yes.
Yeah.
It is scary, and I'm fairly confident that that particular monitoring ability we know is going on because we know that our Defense Department is monitoring communications among literally millions of communications that might be from terrorist organizations. So this is not, that part is not sci-fi. That part is going on.
And do you think putting a moral code in AI is even possible?
I don't know that it is. And that really is kind of the central question that I raise, because for the last 2,000 years, we as humans have been debating on what is morality, what's the right moral code. If we could define it and agree upon it, I think we could probably program an AI program to recognize morality. But what code would you have your AI program follow?
Exactly. Because so much of morality really is situationally dependent.
Absolutely. And as I explore in the book, I mean, there are a couple of times where Ariel kills people, and the creator of Ariel was quite happy that she did. But then there were other times when she killed people. Well, that wasn't quite so appropriate.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So if you're trying to program an artificial intelligence program to make decisions of life and death, when is it okay to kill somebody and when is it not? And of course, we humans,
we don't always get it right.
No, of course not. We're in constant debate about whether it was appropriate just to use contemporary situations, whether it was appropriate, for example, for a police officer to use lethal force on someone mm-hmm. who might be committing a crime.
Yeah.
Would you want to empower a robot to do that?
Not too likely.
It's chaotic enough as it is without that.
Right, wow. Right. So that really is the central theme of the book. Though, as you pointed out, Caroline, there's a whole lot of twists and turns, and it's set in the context of a fairly typical legal thriller. That has, I hope, a compelling storyline, so that this issue, this theme of morality and artificial intelligence, can be explored.
Because actually, our judicial system is very complex, and there's a lot of ins and outs, and it's not always fair. I mean, that's because it's one person's
right.
decision. Yeah, one person's decision can impact a whole lot of people. That that's just the way it is.
And
yes, ma'am, absolutely.
Paul's a corporate attorney, but he sure doesn't trust the judicial system when it comes to criminal.
No.
Yeah.
No, Paul has had too much experience himself with understanding the limitations of the justice system, and rather than in a critical point in the book, rather than him turning himself over to the police and saying, I trust you in resolving this in a fair and equitable manner, and I leave my my own fate in your hands, he hops in his car and runs for South Georgia to get away. So that tells you what he thinks about the justice system.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Pat McKee, author of Ariel's Island. Now, the kind of underlying court case that you refer to in the part that you read, and that's kind of the engine underneath everything else that happens here, is an intellectual property case. Why did you choose that field?
Well, it overlaps with a lot of contemporary issues that are interesting to people. And as you know, in this particular case, what I did was is I made the case turn on several very valuable patents. And these patents were to certain HIV drugs that had the potential to end the scourge of AIDS. And, of course, I thought that would give, high drama to a court case if we had had some drugs that would be potentially able to end AIDS throughout the world. And used the analogy to Johanna Salk, who ended polio. And I had always found his example to be just remarkably inspiring. He could have become a multi-billionaire back in the 50s by creating the polio vaccine, yet he gave it he created it and gave it to everyone for free so that the polio scourge could be eliminated. And I found that to be so incredibly compelling. And so in this particular case, the good guys in our case were going to make the vaccine that they came up with for ending HIV, they were going to make that free to everybody, and the bad guys came in and they were going to try to take it and make a lot of money out of it. So that mm-hmm. set up basic, dramatic tension for the case.
And kind of the case sort of turned on this one Supreme Court ruling. Was that an actual ruling, or was that something that you fictionalized for this purpose?
No, it's an actual Supreme Court case. Halo
oh.
Electronic.
Oh,
yes,
wow.
It's a real case. Yeah. And it really did make a big change in intellectual property cases. And I used that to dramatize, what happened in this particular case. And where people, people that don't, aren't in the, legal profession, they hear of, big cases and courts overruling courts and other things, and they feel like, well, that's the end of it. Well, it's not really. When when the Supreme Court overrules a precedent, it sets dominoes tumbling, on into infinity almost, because of the people build their businesses, they build their legal strategies, they build all kinds of things based upon an assumption as to how the law is going to be in the future. And when the Supreme Court or another court changes that, it's a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
It's ripple through everything.
It's interesting. In criminal law situations, sometimes rulings are actually, we had a case that I'm familiar with in the Iowa Supreme Court where a ruling was made to say that the felony murder rule was unconstitutional when the act that was the felony and the act that caused the death were the same act, that you couldn't apply the felony murder rule to basically override the need to prove premeditation or intent.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
But that ruling was ruled, they specifically said it will not be made retroactive. And so...
Uh-huh.
There are people, there are probably at least 100 inmates in Iowa who are in life for life without possibility of parole under a, having been prosecuted under law later ruled unconstitutional.
How about that? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty striking.
I know.
Yeah.
And so the pivotal decision, Supreme Court decision, which is mentioned in the second chapter in this book, was a real live Supreme Court decision that changed a certain aspect of intellectual property law, primarily what it would take to get in front of a jury to prove punitive damages, which in these kinds of cases. Intellectual property, when you're dealing with pharmaceuticals and things, you're talking about billions of dollars.
Oh, wow.
So, anyway, I wanted the stakes to be really high and make it interesting for you.
So, Pat, I read that you are a member of the Atlanta Writers Group. How long has that group been going, and how does it work?
Well, the Atlanta Writers Guild is over 100 years old. It is a wonderful group, and they have been extraordinarily helpful to me. One of the things that they put on is a writer's conference. And in the writer's conference, they bring together folks like me, aspiring writers, and agents, and publishers, and they let the aspiring writers, it's kind of like speed dating. You get about 5 minutes in front of an agent, 5 minutes in front of a publisher, and you can make your pitch, and they'll take a look at a couple of chapters of your book and tell you if they think it's worthwhile. So that, to me, in the past had been extremely helpful. As you know, it can be very discouraging, if you will, to get publishers and agents constantly telling you no thanks or not even answering your inquiries. So if you can get in front of somebody and they can tell you, yeah, this is a pretty good idea, I'd be interested in you know, hearing from you. That was just very helpful, very encouraging, and it's done a lot for many, many writers. So I believe the Atlanta Writers Conference put on by the Atlanta Writers Guild is one of the finest conferences I've been to.
And you won an award from this guild, I believe.
Yes, as a matter of fact. Yeah, as a matter of fact, one of the things that you can do is that you can present a sample of your manuscript to a publisher, and you know, they will review it. And I won 2 years in a row the best manuscript sample at the Atlanta Writers Conference, and that gave me the encouragement I needed to keep trying, even though you know, I couldn't find a major publishing company to publish my book. I did ultimately find an independent publisher, a really fine group of folks, and the name of that publisher is Southern Fried Karma. It's out of Atlanta, and they publish folks like me that have not been able to make it with big publishers, but have an interesting story to tell.
Wow. How many books do they publish a year? Do you know?
I would, you know, my guess is probably, you know, a half a dozen to a dozen. So they're a relatively small group. And Steve McCondici is the prime mover of Southern Fried Karma, and he's out looking for you know, interesting stories and interesting writers. So I would certainly encourage anybody to get in touch with look up Southern Fried Karma. They have a nice website.
I'm looking at it right now, and it says Cultivating Artistic Voices of the New Millennium with a Southern Accent. So I'm guessing you have to have a little bit of a Southern spin, Southern location or something.
It might help, yeah.
but many, there, it seems like there are these small independent regional publishers spread across the United States, and they're really a good home for a lot of writers. In Iowa, we have Ice Cube Press up in North Liberty. They probably do half a dozen to a dozen books a year as well. It's a very small team, but the quality of the books is very high.
Well, I hope that you would agree that the production quality of Ariel's Island is as good as any you'll see.
Well, what do you think, Mom? I only got the digital version. I didn't get to see the hard copy.
Oh yeah, it's the cover is very interesting. I mean, it's part of the page turner because you know what is that all about?
I think the cover is really fascinating. I'll just kind of describe it generally. It's a stormy sea with a pair of eyes that are staring out at you. And one of the things that I had hoped that we could do was echo one of the more famous book covers that was ever done, and that was The Great Gatsby. And if you remember the eyes in The Great Gatsby, that book cover is a true classic, and I thought the eyes would be helpful to give that kind of mysterious feel that you got, Caroline, in looking at the cover.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you have that person swimming in between
right.
the eyes, and that you think, oh, my goodness, what is going on?
Yeah, right. Well, good. I'm so glad. I had nothing to do with that. That's part of the production team at Southern Fried Karma that came up with that book cover.
Now, did you end up seeing or having an editor, or excuse me, an agent? Did you end up having an agent, or did you go directly to the publisher yourself?
I went directly to the publisher, and the publisher, Steve, had been a writer who had had the same experience that I did, and that is that people found his work good, but he never could get an agent to represent him. And so I went to Steve directly without an agent and said, here, I think you'll like this. And he did, and I thank God that he had the confidence in me to take on my book.
From the time he took it on, did you work much with them in terms of editing, or was it pretty final before you gave it to them?
That's a really good question. He had an extraordinarily fine concept editor, and he read the manuscript and suggested some extremely, extremely valuable changes. And like I said, I changed the beginning and the end, and as a result of his comments, that's how the current beginning and the current ending came about, from his comments. So they were extremely helpful.
It sounds like you are not one of these writers who it's like, well, that's the way I wrote it, I'm going to leave it that way, but that you are open to feedback and editing, which is actually very important if you want to be successfully published.
Yeah, I feel strongly about my work, but I also feel that there are other people out there who have a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge and can be very, very helpful in developing a strong book. So their editing staff was top notch.
Now, let's go back to the book a little bit. There's a character that gets introduced a little ways in who's really helps Paul a lot, a man named Gray.
Right.
Is he based on someone in real life?
Well, yes, as a matter of fact. I will say that I in my experience, I have worked with, I was in the state attorney general's office, and I worked with a number of GBI, Georgia Bureau of Investigation agents. And he's something of a composite of some of the agents that I have met over the years. And they are, you know, extremely interesting people. And what I wanted to convey with Agent Gray that no matter how rough the package, how rough the exterior, inside was an extraordinarily capable person. In this particular instance, he's a graduate of Georgia Tech in computer surveillance and has a master's degree from Vanderbilt in psychology. So he's not some dumb redneck living out in the woods.
He's a smart guy living out in the woods.
He's a smart guy living out in the woods, and he chose to do that, right?
Right, right.
And a lot, you know, and there are a lot of smart people that do choose to live out in the woods, and that's something very important for people to know.
Yep, and he's not fond of the feds. Is that
no, not fond of the feds?
Is that something you found as common in the GBI?
I am not going to attribute that to the GBI. I don't want either the FBI or the GBI to be coming down on me and saying, look, you've been saying bad things about us. No, I will say this. There is a little of interagency jealousy among all law enforcement groups that I have seen, you know, in my experience, that you have some people, you know, think, you know, this is my turf and you don't need to get on my turf. And I think it's fair to say that there is some, I would say jealousy, as far as, various, agencies go, but that's as far as I'm going to go.
Well, you certainly see that on TV and the movies. So I was just wondering if that was just a trope or if that was based on reality. And it sounds like it is based on reality.
Yeah. In my judgment, yes, it is based on reality for sure.
Well, we are getting close to being out of time.
Oh, no.
Do you have any – I know the book is being released March 31st, and so we're recording that this before that date, but you may be listening to it after that date. And where will Ariel's Island be available?
So Ariel's Island will be available on Amazon. As a matter of fact,
you can pre-order.
It is currently currently available on Amazon to pre-order.
Right.
So it is available, and I ask all of your faithful listeners to go out and get a copy of Ariel's Island and enjoy it.
It's a fun read.
And it is. It's very exciting.
And, Mom, do you have some final words of wisdom for us today?
Well, I had a couple things, but in this time of technology and the use of more various things like artificial intelligence, we have no way of knowing what the next thing will be. Just remember that because it is new and exciting does not make it necessarily good for mankind.
Amen.
That's for sure. That's for sure. And thank you all for being with us today, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you.
Bye now.